her behalf. She tugged the oversized gray sweatshirt that her cousin Lucy had advised her to burn over the pajamas. Alice told herself she donned the sweatshirt because she felt a chill. But there was no denying the extra layer. A polyester cotton blend breastplate made her feel less vulnerable. She stood there, facing the door, waiting for the sound of the key in the lock. Then, feeling foolish, she advanced and swung the door open at the same moment Nicholas reached it. They stood there, silent, glaring at each other, waiting. But for what? For the other to blink first? Everything she wanted to say to him, every word she had rehearsed in anticipation of this moment, failed her. Alice felt her anger begin to turn to tears. That she would not allow to happen. She spun on her heel and strode back into her apartment. Her apartment. She drew a feeble courage from the knowledge she was the mistress of this shabby, threadbare domain. She heard the clack of the closing door, followed by the sound of footsteps that signaled he was drawing near. Alice turned back to find his eyes weren't focused on her, but darting around her quarters.
"You didn't have to do this," he said,
disdain obvious in his glance, if not his tone.
"Move into,"
he gestured with a rolling wave of his hand around them.
"Into private quarters. My house will always be yours."
"Your house was never mine," Alice said, pleased that even though her mind was raging, her voice remained cool. There would be no tears, not now, and certainly not for him to witness. Nicholas didn't respond beyond a steely glint in his eyes. He turned his attention to the rosemary tree.
"Cute," he said,
with an intonation that could either show sincerity or cloak sarcasm.
"She gave it to you?"
"Yes," Alice said, sharpening her tone as she spoke. "She did." It seemed purposeless to ask him how he'd learned of Natalie. Perhaps he had had the decency to alert his other sister of his homecoming before inflicting himself on Alice. Perhaps someone else had told him. There was no shortage of loose tongues, not with so many failing witches seeking to ingratiate themselves with those who still had power. Perhaps he had been spying on her since her return to the common world. It didn't matter. Not really. All that mattered was that she move him off the topic of Natalie before he sullied her name by speaking it. Her curtness chafed him.
"She," he parroted her, "isn't right for you."
Alice barked out an indignant laugh. "Now you want to play father?"
"To start with," he said, brushing off her derision, "you're 22. She's 33. The age difference is inappropriate. Distasteful."
He gave each syllable of the word its full measure. "You're old enough to be Evangeline Casey's father," she said, noticing he winced at her name. "That didn't stop you from seeing her."
"No," he said,
his usual ramrod straight posture curving into a question mark.
"But it did, in the end, factor into the failure of the relationship."
He paused, his softening gaze suggesting he was reliving the romance's denouement.
"Although the final nail in the coffin was her implying I'd murdered my own son."
He shook his head. "There is no coming back from that." A lopsided grin joined his narrowing eyes to show he'd regained the arrogance of which regret, or perhaps simple wounded pride, had, for an instant, deprived him. Alice rushed to speak before he could return to his unwelcome offering of counsel. "I lived 7 years on the Dreaming Road, in the time since you took off on your pilgrimage. In my mind, I feel much closer to her age."
"Regardless," Your birth certificate still says you're 22.
My birth certificate still says you're my father.
This blow landed.
He fell silent, scanning her face as if she were a puzzle to solve. He crossed to the round, possibly vintage, chrome and red formica dining table, straddling the bare floorboards of the kitchen area in the dingy beige of the worn shag rug that demarcated the living area. He pulled out one of the plastic stacking chairs, also red, but not vintage, just cheap, and sat.
You know nothing about her, about her family. There are matters surrounding the Boudreaux family to which you should be made privy.
Wait. Alice held up a hand to stop him. Now she got it. This isn't about Natalie. It's about Lincoln. Lincoln and Evangeline. You're hoping to manipulate me into trying to drive them apart. And if doing so hurts my relationship with Natalie, well, you'd consider me justifiable collateral damage. Again. Nicholas kicked out his legs and huffed as if from exasperation. Admit it. It's killing you to see her with someone else. With someone who makes her happy. Nicholas flushed red and opened his mouth to speak, but then appeared to think better of it. His shoulders slumped as his expression shifted from irritation to sadness.
This isn't about Evangeline, but you're right that it's about Lincoln and his brother.
He paused, waving his hand, pretending to search for the name.
Washington.
Wiley, Alice said. He goes by Wiley, and he's a good guy. He's good for Hugo.
He's unworthy of Hugo.
Nicholas let his words trail off, letting what was left unsaid be heard loud and clear. He waited for her reaction, but Alice refused to take the bait.
They're killers, he said in a low, matter-of-fact voice that left no room to think he might be joking. Executioners, to be precise.
Executioners? He shrugged.
Magic is about to flatline, but the Boudreaux have always been good soldiers to the last man.
He paused, then fixed her with his gaze.
To the last witch.
I don't know what you're trying to convince me of, but
there are laws. Laws of conduct among witches, many Byzantine, most overlooked, and by and large unenforced. But there remain a handful that are considered immutable.
Such as?
Such as thou shalt not assist thy not altogether dead grandfather in the slaughter of witches at his own memorial ball.
He rapped his knuckles on the table and grimaced.
I do apologize. I should have said, father, not grandfather. I understand you relished passing on that sordid tidbit to the masses.
He raised his hand to his heart, an involuntary gesture, she felt sure. For a moment, she wondered if this act could be more than a prideful man's reaction to public humiliation, if it betrayed an ambivalence on his part as well. Perhaps he regretted his lies, his desertion, that he couldn't find it in his heart to love her. Everyone knows Celestin took me to the Dreaming Road by force, that I didn't play a role in the massacre.
Oh, do they?
He said, feigning innocence.
Even after what you got up to at Pressoisson? Ripping the gates off their hinges? You are foolish to indulge in such theatrics before magic-starved witches.
It wasn't theatrics. I wanted to send the message that I wouldn't let myself be anyone's victim, ever. She fell silent, acknowledging to herself that the message hadn't been for the benefit of the toothless witches who'd gathered in the cemetery,
hoping to walk away with a magical relic, ready to snatch up fingers, ears, or even a pinky toe. The message was for Celestin. A farewell to ring through every cell of this consciousness-haunted corpse as the witches carved it up and parceled it out. "And quite the message you sent, too," Nicholas said, his words trampling over her thoughts.
"You're strong. You're powerful. More powerful than most of the witches in the Gulf region combined."
He paused, a glint in his black eyes.
"You're hard."
This he said with a timbre that hinted at pride. Then he smirked and mimed hacking off his left hand and tossing it into the crowd, a parody of her dismembering his, their, father's body.
"You could be. No. You are dangerous."
She looked back on the day, and for an instant saw herself as another might. She must have been, as Fleur had later told her, horrifying. Glorious. She had only been brought back from the perfect hell Celestin had built for her on the Dreaming Road hours before. Daniel had given his life to save her, and if it weren't for Natalie, they would have lost Hugo too. A fact she ought to share with the man who stood before her, criticizing the woman who had saved his child, now his only child. Alice had been traumatized, maybe even a bit out of her mind. Would she act in the same manner today if given the chance to reconsider? Once again, she felt the heft of the athame in her hand. In her imagination, she could see the gleam of the dying sun on its fine blade. Her hand moved, a nearly involuntary action, and again she felt the blade slice in a single swift stroke through withering flesh and brittle bone. Nicholas studied her face, then nodded as if in agreement with himself.
"You've got a lot of your mother in you."
"You do,"
he said, emphasizing the last two words as if he anticipated an objection. Ambivalence prevented her from doing so. She felt butterflies in her stomach and placed a hand over the fluttering spot. She hoped she did share her mother's strength, but feared the seeds of Astrid Anderson Marin's darkness might be germinating within her. Maybe it was only her time in the hospital on Sinclair, the years when her magic had been tamped down and kept in check, that had kept those seeds from reaching maturity and bearing fruit. Now it felt as if nothing could constrain her.
"There are laws," he said, wagging an accusatory finger at her, as if he were certain she'd broken more than a few. "And there are those who enforce them."
He cocked an eyebrow.
"Strange, isn't it?
There are only..." He paused, making a show of counting his fingers.
"Five witches of any true ability left in New Orleans, and three of them are sharing their beds with the Boudreaux?"
The butterflies in her stomach caught fire.
Alice wasn't. Not yet.
Maybe not ever. But her love life was none of his business.
"I must admit,"
he said with exaggerated nodding,
"I am beginning to feel a bit left out. I wouldn't mind having a go at the younger Boudreaux boy myself."
A sly smile rose to his face as he savored her surprise.
"Not all of us are as narrow in our tastes as you and our hapless Hugo seem to be."
Her blushing discomfort sated his desire to shock her.
"I'm sorry,"
he said, though his tone was anything but apologetic.
"I'd assumed anyone who's spent 7 years on the Dreaming Road would have a more cosmopolitan perspective on matters of the flesh."
He had succeeded in driving home his point about her immaturity and the common world age difference between Natalie and herself. He leaned toward her.
"Or are you the worldly-wise habitué of the dreaming road. Uncomfortable discussing sexuality with me, because an infinitesimal part of you still sees me as your father. Despite your very public disavowal. He covered his face with his hands, giving her the impression that he had revealed more than he would like about his own hurt. When he lowered his hands, his face had lost all vitality. He looked older. He looked tired.
I didn't come to fight with you. The fact is, I didn't even come to comment on your life choices. I only came because I wanted to warn you that your actions may have unintended consequences. You've brought a lot of attention on yourself, and with a serial killer for a patriarch, we Marins were already under intense scrutiny.
A vague enough admonition. Alice reasoned the true goal of this encounter was to frighten her so that she would seek shelter under the canopy of Nicholas's protection. His visit was a last-ditch effort to regain control over her. The thought should have rekindled the flame of her anger, but it didn't. Maybe because she no longer felt afraid. Alice realized she, too, had lost her will to battle. Rather than vengeance, she wanted answers. She might never have such a ripe opportunity to get them.
I met her, you know, Alice said. I met Astrid. On the dreaming road.
His eyes widened ever so slightly. A sign, Alice took it, of true surprise.
And how is my dear devoted wife?
His tone was biting, but Alice could sense the news had thrown him. Alice couldn't tell whether he truly still cared about Astrid, or if he was simply buying time to regain his footing.
She's gone now, Alice said, searching his expression for the answer to that question. She saw only amused incredulity. His disbelief felt like a challenge.
The world Astrid inhabited was collapsing around us as we spoke. She had no way out.
Oh, she had a way out. Astrid always has a scapegoat for the devil and a life raft for the deep blue sea. I suspect she'll still be carrying on long after the human race has died out and radioactive cockroaches rule the world.
She confessed everything to me.
You may rest assured anything she said to you was either a lie or a misdirection.
He paused, seeming to reconsider.
Maybe you aren't so much like her after all. You enjoy a capacity for truth Astrid was born without.
Says the man who pretended to be my father. The only thing Astrid had ever given Alice, perhaps the only thing she ever had to give Alice, was her story. Alice was unwilling to let Nicholas strip away the value of Astrid's bequeathal by shedding doubt on it.
Says the man who tried his best to be a father to you.
Alice startled, stunned by the assertion. You must be joking.
No need to provoke or dissimulate. I see you are seeking an answer to the big why. Sinclair Isle, and its psychiatric care for those deranged with magic, as well as those deranged by magic. Why did I abandon a perfectly sane little girl there? The answer is simple, whether you choose to accept it or not.
He leaned back in the chair and crossed his arms over his chest.
I put you there to keep you safe. Safe from Celestin, certainly. But most of all from Astrid. I knew she'd find her way back. Eventually. Once she got her claws into the Book of the Unwinding.
He sighed, and forced his body into a less defensive pose, uncrossing his arms and folding his hands on the table.
I'm not certain for what purpose, but Celestin and Astrid made you to serve as a tool. Of one thing you may rest assured, your mother had a use for you.
Otherwise, you would never have been born. Separating you from them, from your magic by means of the hospital's safeguards, seemed to be the best way to ensure your safety and, he shrugged, the well-being of the rest of us. Don't forget, the heir to magic can't have children. If Astrid still had her sights set on capturing the last breath of magic, she would have mowed both you and Hugo down without a second thought. And if Celestin believed he might be the lucky witch, he would have done the same to all of us.
They had a falling out, Alice said. Celestin trapped her on the Dreaming Road, just like he...
I, Nicholas said, holding up his hands to stop her. I trapped Astrid on the Dreaming Road. Luke's 10th birthday. You were a newborn. I came upon her reading to the three of you from the Lesser Key of Darkness, letting Luke turn the pages as if it were a children's picture book. A slight shake of the head signaled that he still couldn't comprehend Astrid's actions. A present, she called it. I snatched the book away and tried to burn it in the fireplace. Luke tried to dodge around me and rescue his gift. Hugo did as Hugo does. He escaped the room. You lay in the bassinet, wailing. I had a full blaze in the fireplace, but the key wouldn't burn. The flames danced around it, but they wouldn't touch it. Astrid bounded around the room, screaming as if I'd set her alight, rather than that damnable grimoire. She didn't stop shrieking until she managed to recover the book. That's when I realized the degree to which Astrid was connected to the key. I began laying the trap. It took a few months, but I succeeded. She fought like the Hellcat she is, but I succeeded. I forced her psyche from the common world onto the Dreaming Road, or at least the hinterlands. Had I known Babu Jean had turned it into his own private whorehouse, I might have pushed her even harder. But I only recently learned that tidbit about the Storyville construct from your loquacious cousin. Ah, Lucy had been his source of information. Alice felt certain there had been no ill intent on Lucy's part, only her customary lack of discretion. Nicholas fell silent, his eyes landing on the easel standing in the corner. It's a shame about Daniel, he said, his voice hushed in a moment of quiet candor. Alice tried to blink back a tear, but the thought of her former nanny and oldest friend giving himself up to save her tore her apart every time it bubbled up in her mind. To her surprise, she witnessed a tear trace a path down Nicholas's cheek. He was one of a kind, our Daniel, he said, wiping away the offending tear and rising. I'm sorry for disturbing you so late. This reunion might have gone better in the light of day. I doubt it, Alice said without rancor, her response bringing a laugh from Nicholas. No, I'm sure you're right. He turned toward the door. You think they might be coming after me? She called after him. He looked over his shoulder at her. The Boudreaux brothers? He shook his head as he made his way to the door. Not after you, my dear. You could handle them. I fear they're coming after Fleur. Fleur? Why would they want to harm her? You know why, he said, stopping to look back as he grasped the knob. The spell she worked. For Lucy. To bring one person back to life, she would have had to sacrifice another. He opened the door, turning away.
"Our sweet floor," he said as he stepped over the threshold, "is a murderess."
4. Blood, sex, dreaming, intoxication, adoration, deprivation, madness. Astrid Anderson Marin rested one pale hand on the moonlit silver trunk of a bald cypress, reaching out with the other to touch the words flickering before her, their fire cold and blacker than the midnight blue night air in which they hovered. They evanesced at her touch, others coalescing to take their place. "These are the gates to magic, of which madness is the greatest, for madness is the utter surrender to magic." The words dissipated as a young man, a teenager, crab-walked toward her at a furious clip, his broad shoulders straining the fabric of his royal blue-and-white letterman's jacket. A shing resounded as Babu Jean's razor-blade smile showed itself on her lips. The boy cried out at the sight of her and pushed back in the opposite direction, trying to launch himself toward safety, but instead landed flat on his back before her feet. Astrid gazed down at him, a beautiful boy with a square jaw and thick, curling locks that gleamed golden even in the cooling light of the moon. His body was strong, athletic, pleasing in proportion, a true Adonis. He might have escaped Grunch Road had he not twisted his ankle on a treacherous tree root. "There is neither a left hand nor a right hand path. Threefold, singular, serpentine, the way of truth." The young woman who had come with them to Grunch Road had shown herself to be more fleet of foot than her lover. Astrid smiled, pleased the female offering would provide Rose with a much-needed challenge. Rose dearly loved to exercise her newly limber body, but she had been let go from Bonne Nouvelle for getting into a fistfight with another one of the dancers. Astrid hoped tonight's outing would bring an end to her tiresome pouting. The boy screamed as a shrieking Rose gained on him. Then she swung the sharp blade of her axe low, silencing him. Rose snatched the head up by its curls and sniffed the wind. "Here, girly girly," Rose called out. "Your boyfriend has a kiss for you," she laughed, a cackle, really. Dark magic, and the book had revealed to Astrid that all magic is, at its root, dark, could steal the warmth from a witch's laughter, leaving it nothing but a screech to send shivers down a lesser being's spine. Listening through Babu Jean's sensitive ears, Astrid heard the laughter have this exact effect on the young woman, who had, like a fool, hidden rather than attempt to circle back to the car. The terrified girl failed to suppress a sound that fell somewhere between a gasp and moan. Rose bounded forward, making a beeline toward the source of the noise, rising a foot off the ground as she did. Another scream, another silence. "Murder was the first act of magic. Murder will be the last. Every time. Every time." Two most revelatory words. This had all happened before. The fall of the King of Bones and Ashes. The rise of the Queen of Heaven. The agonized union of opposites. A dissonance that conveyed magic, a stream of pure potential, into the common world. The inconsolable maiden who weeps at the gate for her missing bridegroom is the whore who coupled with the groom for silver, and the huntress who ensnared and devoured him, who rent him from limb to limb. Kiss her bloody lips, surrender to her noxious seduction, for she is holy. She is magic. Once, Astrid had dreamed of becoming the queen, but the book would not have her. It offered her instead the role of Mater Dolorosa. In the end, and this was the end, she had proved nothing more than a blind midwife. Evangeline Casey, the swamp witch, would be queen. Preposterous. But Astrid sensed Evangeline had been born, perhaps even bred, to play the role. Evangeline's mother, Muleya, had carried the spark of the Book of the Unwinding inside her to these shores, much as she had later carried Evangeline in her womb. The book had been present at Evangeline's conception, perhaps had even had a hand in molding her. Certainly, an affinity existed between the book and the Casey girl. Well, really woman now. Mura finds in the night what Psyche loses in the light. The goring beast, the glory of the king of bones and ashes, he who steals his father's fire to light the heavens and set the world ablaze. Rose trudged backward, dragging the girl's remains along with her, and dropped the body alongside that of the boy. She scanned their surroundings until she spotted a tree stump, upon which she then sat, resting the axe's blade between her knees and its handle between her chin and shoulder. She began pushing an implement she had called a bastard file along the bit of the blade. The instrument made a whisking sound like Babu Jean's teeth as it sharpened the edge. Astrid knew this wasn't an act of maintenance. It was foreplay. Eventually the scraping stopped, and the witch stood and cast a glance at Astrid before meandering off in the direction of the thin, crooked finger of lagoon that bisected the dirt lane known as Grunch Road. Sacrifice was, after all, thirsty work. Psyche's dim torch lights infinity in fear, her blade poised to carve the boundless into chaos. Chaos is potentiality fleeing reason. When Astrid first read the Book of the Unwinding, its message had been inked by the mist of Eli Landry's blood. Astrid recognized what she was now witnessing was an illusion, an afterimage of the text she had been blessed to receive. For all the lies told and conjectures made over the centuries about the book, she had found one to be true. The book could only be read once. Yes, she had sacrificed everything for a book that could be read once. That single reading merited each and every forfeit. Madness is never blinded by reality. Astrid repeated the thought aloud, the word never, a tickle on the tongue. The utterance acted like a charm, revealing a man who stood silent, observing, on the clearing's periphery. The light of the waxing moon seemed to melt around him rather than illuminate his features, but Astrid didn't need to see his face to recognize him. She knew him. For whom he pretended to be. For what he was. And for what hid behind that. He had placed her foot on the first step of her descent. It seemed only fitting he should witness the end of her journey. The darkest heart rejoices at its own bereavement. The darkest heart, unflinching, sees truth. As a restorer of magical texts, Astrid had encountered hundreds of grimoires, preserved dozens, and returned many one-of-a-kind works to functionality, if not their original condition. Even now,
She carried in her mind a catalog of all extant, lost, and legendary grimoires. She had once included the Book of the Unwinding in this last category. Astrid was on the cusp of finishing her apprenticeship at the Atelier Magnusson when a down-at-the-heels old man swept into the workshop with the presumptuousness of royalty in exile. He wore a threadbare brown wool jacket with cream pinstripes, its elbows shiny from long and, as evinced by the musk it exuded, constant wear and two large pants of maroon polyester. In his mottled hand, he clutched a battered leather-bound and, Astrid could spot from 10 paces, counterfeit copy of the Lesser Key. The poor fool, she surmised, had squandered the last of his resources on the shoddy forgery. Astrid had encountered the Lesser Key twice before, once protected by wards and unbreakable glass during her studies, and again while taking inventory of her deceased aunt's collection. Astrid had acquired her love for books, of both the arcane and common variety, from her aunt. The Lesser Key exuded an undeniable magnetism, one strong enough to capture the imagination of the credulous and to bend the will of the weak. Potent enough even to ensnare many otherwise astute witches. Sensing the Lesser Key's allure, Astrid had dared to take hold of her aunt's copy and witness firsthand the tiny cilia-like shadows reaching out to test and seduce those it might. But she had not been seduced by the book's prickling overture. If anything, its predatory approach and trickster energy had repulsed her. She'd included her aunt's edition of the work among the texts to be turned over to the occult library in Bluacula. After experiencing the Lesser Key herself, she conjectured the tract had been created as a kind of insidious hoax. Its purpose was most likely to collect magic from beguiled witches, or perhaps, crueler even, it had been created for no other reason than to ensnare the dupable. Desolate and deceived, the witches who had fallen prey to the Lesser Key held on to the delusion that the time and effort put into obtaining and studying this thin volume must be worth something. Like many other fanatics disappointed by a doomsday prophet, these witches maintained hope by assuring themselves the great revelation for which they'd been striving lay just around the bend. If the payout couldn't be found in the pages of the Lesser Key, those pages must point to a greater mystery. The tract's very title hinted a greater key existed. This attempt to keep hope alive, she had once believed, was the origin of the legend of the Book of the Unwinding. A mercurial fairy tale she had long believed the Book of the Unwinding to be, as slippery and ever-changing as the myth of the Golden City of El Dorado, and as gratifying as the stories of the land of milk and honey, Cacaine. Astrid had laughed at the witches who scoured every historical source. Diaries and court records, correspondences, both personal letters and church encyclicals, even bills of lading and ship manifests, regarded warily those who had unearthed graves, some ancient, many fresh. Scorned those who'd attempted true sortilege, offering up their very essence as reward to any entity powerful enough to act as guide. She had held all those who tried to pick up on the book's trail in contempt, albeit a quiet contempt, as many of the atelier's most eminent clients fell into one or more of these camps. All revelation is betrayal. Apostasy. Abandon, abnegation,
Annihilation. The four pillars of revelation. And so she believed the tatty old man who had come to her with the imposter tucked beneath his arm was one of the legion who had been ensnared by a cheap bit of flash. He ignored her male colleague, who had approached him with a guarded offer of assistance, an offer that cloaked his intention to maneuver the threadbare visitor back toward the exit for ease of ejection, and addressed Astrid.
"I'd like to know your opinion of this. It seems to be very old, and perhaps of some value. Cultural, if not pecuniary," he said, in perfect, though oddly accented Swedish.
Many witches remained capable of magic-enabled polyglottery, and others of projecting meaning so their native words would be understood by their interlocutor, even though the commonality of these gifts was fading along with the magic that made them possible. The visitor was using neither of these powers. Astrid decided he had learned her language through study and practice. A witch who did things the hard way all along would, no doubt, fare better than most in the final days of magic. Enlightenment is the absolute betrayal for which the serpent's head is crushed. He held the book out, offering it to her. When she didn't move to accept it, he said,
"I'm sure you'll find it of interest. It isn't the hoax you believe it to be."
She caught her breath, divining the elderly witch had not just picked up on her current snap judgment as to his book's authenticity, but rather her broader suspicions about the lesser key.
"Perhaps our young friend would like to take a break."
He turned to her colleague.
"It's a fine day, quite warm," the old man said, using no doubt the tone the serpent had used when seducing Eve.
Astrid cast an eye out the window, expecting to see the same drizzle that had been falling all morning long, and was surprised to see a patch of blue sky.
"The kind of day," the visitor's voice brought her attention back to him, "that causes one's sap to rise, no?"
He patted her co-worker on the back, the gentle force proving to be the final push her colleague needed. They waited in an unplanned conspiratorial silence until they were alone, the old man beaming at her, and she doing her best to keep her expression impassive. He introduced himself, an odd name that might have been either his given or family. It slipped through her memory almost the moment she heard it. He proffered the book once more, urging her on with an impatient nod. She held back, uncertain. Surely she had better things to do during her final days at the atelier than disabusing an old fool of his fantasies. She attempted to stare him down, hoping he'd take the cue and excuse himself, but he didn't flinch. She decided to make quick work of the task, perform a perfunctory examination, pronounce it a fake, and offer the old man a 200 krona note, enough to purchase his dinner, perhaps even breakfast too, if he dined frugally. With a quick sigh, she accepted the book from him. The moment she touched its leather cover, the moment it touched her, she knew there was something different about this book. It had a pulse. The idea that this was the actual work and every other edition of the lesser key known to the world was a forgery flooded through her. The old man regarded her with a knowing smile and a devilish twinkle in his eye, but he remained as silent and as still as stone. The book reclaimed her attention. Astrid drew a breath and opened it, discovering inside vellum pages cut in a manner that told her this work had begun as a scroll,
It was a codex, rather than a traditional book. The pages were hand-scripted in what she first took to be carmine ink, then recognized as blood. She looked up with surprise. One heard of such things in folklore, but in reality, even in her line of work, such a thing was rare. Rarer still, the blood was not stagnant. Rather, it coursed through the written words. This circulation gave the book its pulse. The lesser keys pages fanned apart without a touch, the book falling open to its center, its beating heart. Images of Inanna and Damuzi danced around each other, their circling movement creating a downward spiral, leading her, or rather inviting her, down into an abyss. The old man snatched the book from her grasp and closed it. She gaped at him in wonder and envy, advancing on him, ready to murder him on the spot to take ownership of it. He placed it, pleased it seemed, into her clutching hands.
"It looks like the key has found the one it sought," he said, giving what seemed to her a mocking bow, before fading into nothingness.
His odd exit should have given her pause, but she felt only relief. It was hers. She wrapped her arms around the gift and held it to her heart. The rhythm of its pulse fell in sync with her own, or perhaps her heartbeat had taken on the cadence of the book. She never saw the old man again. Until now, though she recognized he had always been near. In the common world, on the dreaming road, with invisible, boundless strings, he had led her, his puppet, here to this very clearing, to this very moment. The proud river is enslaved, shackled, silenced by the silt it has swallowed. The savage is tamed, and the earth crumbles beneath its masters. Magic wasn't dying. Magic wasn't fading. Reality floated in the sea of infinite possibility, closed off for the most part. The undiluted, malleable potential trickling into the common world had become known as magic. A person capable of sensing this flow and molding it to their own purposes, a witch. Only the means of conveyance, the rent in the fabric of reality that allowed seepage of undiluted potentiality from beyond, was closing, healing, forcing the flow of magic into an ever-constricting channel. And witches were to blame. At least those witches not willing to make sacrifices to keep the gash wide. The time for sacrifice had come once again. Astrid heard a rustling and looked up to find the old man gone, having once again disappeared as he had the day he'd given her the key. Of course, Evangeline. The realization came to Astrid as her mind turned from thoughts of her son, the King of Bones and Ashes, to Evangeline Casey, the Bayou Queen of Heaven. In a flash, the old man's choice became clear. The old man and Evangeline. Only now did she recognize a family resemblance. December 20, 5. Evangeline Casey awoke with the sun on her face, a resolute beam finding the sole angle that allowed it to reach over the rooftop of the neighboring building and down through her private garden to pierce a pane of her bedroom's French doors. The warmth, the golden glow, should have been pleasant, But like at the New Grange burial mound on winter solstice morning, it tickled the back of the grave and called forth an uneasy awareness. In the night, as Lincoln lay beside her, Evangeline had dreamed of her dead lover. She couldn't remember how it had begun. It felt almost as if Luke had insinuated himself into the progression of a mundane dream. With a flash of his blue-black eyes, he drew closer and closer yet, and then became the night sky, lit only by a sprinkling of stars. Through the omniscience of dream, she knew there were 7 stars, even though the dream defied the waking logic required for counting. One by one they fell, leaving behind a void that was not empty, but rather a realm of eternal potential. Nothing had yet been created, and all was possible. Transcendent. That was the word. In the dream, Evangeline had accepted Luke for what he'd become, perhaps even loved him for it. As the details returned to her, her pulse rose, and a cold finger traced down her spine. She spun over to find her cat once again, staring at her from Lincoln's empty pillow. Sugar regarded her with contemptuous, knowing, peridot green eyes. "Man, you will keep." Sugar had taken to Lincoln with the same degree of ferocity with which she had rejected Nicholas. "Man, you will keep," was how Sugar's name for Lincoln presented itself in Evangeline's mind. Though the phrase could either be a prediction, based on the cat's long-time, intimate knowledge of Evangeline's psyche, or, more likely, given Sugar's affection for Lincoln, combined with her imperious nature, a simple command. "Man, you will keep." Evangeline reached over to run her hand down the cat's back. Sugar accepted the show of affection with an air of noblesse oblige, then, with a cool meow, rose and slunk away. Evangeline hadn't yet earned a pardon for temporarily turning the cat over to Hugo in Daniel's care. "Daniel. Poor fellow. Odd fellow. Not really a fellow at all." Daniel had started out as nothing more than conjured energy, a servitor spirit created to act as nanny to the Marin children. He had raised Luke and Hugo. He would have raised Alice, too, if she hadn't been taken from him. Several weeks had now passed since he had given himself to free Alice from the dreaming road. Evangeline rose and dressed, tugging on some jeans and Lincoln's gray hoodie. His scent trapped in the fabric comforted her, pushing away the dream and the feelings of guilt attached to it. A pair of shoes, and she was out the door, making her way to Bourbon Street, following behind a street washer that left the fragrance of dish soap-scented urine in its wake. She noticed something amiss the moment she set foot on the body end of Bourbon Street. Bonne Nouvelle was still blocks away, but the club was close enough for her to spot Lincoln outside, grasping the handle of a bucket with his left hand and scrubbing the windows with a brush. A pair of women came up behind him and paused. One shrugged and shook her head, causing the elf hat she wore to jingle. They carried on toward Evangeline. The taller of the two nodded a tinkling greeting at the same moment her friend spoke a word that stopped Evangeline in her tracks. "Babylon." "I'm sorry?" she said. "No, sweetie, you're good," the taller woman said, misinterpreting Evangeline's question for an apology and stepping down off the curb to make way for Evangeline. "You please excuse us two hicks." "Merry Christmas," her friend called back to Evangeline. "Merry Christmas." Evangeline gave the rote response without even considering the meaning of the phrase. She walked through her own words, growing angrier with each pounding step until she arrived at Bonne Nouvelle. Lincoln had managed to scrape most of the tag off the window glass,
but the Muntin strips holding the individual panes in place still bore the scarlet paint. Enough of the scrawl remained for Evangeline to see the women she had passed had guessed correctly. Someone had sprayed the word Babylon across the front of the club. There was no question in her mind as to who'd done it. For 5 years, Reverend Bill had made a habit of camping out in front of Bonne Nouvelle, preaching against her and predicting her imminent downfall. Though of late, Evangeline found herself missing his contemptuous harangues. A couple of months earlier, the good reverend had lost what little alcohol-drenched mind he had had left. Oh, sure, he still called her the great whore. But the term had changed somehow, from an affront to a veneration.
"I'm sorry, Kerr," Lincoln said, lowering his scrub brush and offering her a wan smile. "I'd hoped to get this taken care of before you woke up, but it looks like it's going to take some paint. Maybe some primer first, too."
He dropped the brush into the bucket, then set the bucket down on the sidewalk.
"On the bright side, it seems I still have a bit of magic left in me. I had a premonition something was wrong around here. I didn't see the details like I used to, but..."
"You would have told me?" Evangeline said, her anger at the vandal shifting onto the closest target. "You weren't just going to fix things for the little woman?"
"No,"
he said, with an uneasy laugh. He approached her and placed his hands on her shoulders.
"I wouldn't have kept you in the dark, though I'd hoped to clean it up before you had to see it. That's what people who love each other do, you know. They take care of each other."
Her face flushed hot, and she felt her pulse in her neck. There she stood, staring up into the face of the only man who had ever loved her enough to put her first, and still she wanted to strike out. Her dream of Luke crept back into her thoughts, bringing 6 suitcases of guilt along with it. She was angry. There were no two ways about it. She was angry with the sanctimonious son of a bitch who'd defaced her club, and she was angry with herself for what felt like an emotional infidelity. But she wasn't angry with Lincoln. "No," she said. "I'm the one who's sorry." She leaned into his chest, and he tightened his arms around her.
"I know," he whispered into her ear. "You can take care of yourself. God knows you always have. All I'm asking is for you to let me in. To let me help."
He kissed her temple before relaxing his embrace.
"Okay,"
he said, first nodding his own head, then, with a sly smile, catching her chin between his thumb and index finger, and nodding her head as well. She reached up and took his hand in hers. It felt rough and strong and sticky from the soapy water he'd been using to remove the paint. It was real. Not the phantom limb of some ghost her subconscious had manufactured and trotted out to punish her for being happy. And she was, she realized, happy, for the first time in her whole dang life. She kissed his hand, and he laughed when she made a face, tasting the cleaner.
"That's how romance works in the real world. Here, share some of that with me," he said, and tugged her in for a kiss on the lips.
She let herself relax into him. She felt his heartbeat an inch or two above her own. "Don't worry about fixing this. I'll call the owner. It's about time they paid for a little maintenance on this place." She felt Lincoln stiffen.
"I don't think that's necessary. It'll get done quicker if I take care of it."
She took a step back and studied first his cautious expression and then his darkening aura. "You're keeping something from me." He took a deep breath and shrugged.
"Why, yes. Yes, I am. But right now you have a more pressing problem."
He nodded toward the window.
"I got your friend the parson locked up in the storage cage, and you need to decide what we're going to do with him."
Evangeline felt her ire rise once more.
She shook her head at Lincoln, but bit her tongue as she pushed past him. The storeroom was dark. One of the two overhead lamps, the one directly over the cage, had burned out, and the other was dimming, as if the light was being drained from it.